Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet and Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News. Paul, Mayor Dan Sullivan presents the Assembly with two versions of the municipal budget for next year. Tell us the tale of two budgets.
Well, it's the A and B budget. I'm sure there'll be a C, D, E, and F budget before it's over with. The A budget, the city is facing a $30 million shortfall in revenues to cover its budget or proposed budget. The A budget is $448 million and includes a lot of cuts, draconian cuts. We lose 187 jobs, we lose 29 cops, we lose all manner of services and whatnot throughout the city. Then there's the B budget, and the B budget is about $460 million, and it's substantially higher than the A budget because it adds in money from the school district. At some point recently, the state decided that it would limit how much money, property taxpayers' money, could go to schools. So we have $12 million left over, if you will, if you want to put it in those terms, in this city this year. He added that $12 million to the B budget proposal, if you will, and we wind up with losing only 92 positions, 10 of them, which are then 10 positions that are filled. So the B budget kind of appeals to those who like the status quo and is not going to appeal to those who want to cut city government in half and then burn down City Hall. That's not going to appeal to them. The decision, though, on whether to use that $12 million, interestingly enough, goes to the Assembly, which is why I say there's likely to be a C, D, E, and F budget before this thing is over with. But they have to actually opt to put that $12 million out like that.
Let's get Steve McDonald in here. Steve, what would the cuts mean to Anchorage services?
Well, Paul did a great job of outlining the differences between A and B, but as you can imagine, A would mean, as he said, lost cops. There would be fire stations that would be closed. There would be one of those big, I can't remember exactly what they call it, but there would be an engine company, I think, that would be shut down in Eagle River. That has a lot of people fearful of increasing the response time to fires and other kinds of emergencies. The library gets it again, shorter hours. It almost kind of smacks of a
And the branch libraries in particular.
Yeah. Libraries always seem to be on the chopping block, and they would get chopped pretty good in terms of the number of hours they would be open. We'd lose police officers. Parks and Rec, again, that's another perennial target of budget cuts. And when you're looking at public safety and you're looking at parks, you can understand the priority there, of course. But parks would be hit pretty badly. Under the B budget, they get dinged. Parks do, but not nearly as badly as they would under the A budget. And I think Paul's right, there's going to be a C version and things like that coming up too. And I wonder if anybody's going to start pushing to say, okay, well, let's tax to the limit of the tax cap.
There'll be somebody who'll do that, don't you?
Mayor Sullivan's been reticent to do that in his 3.5 years now in office. He's not proposed any taxing to the tax cap. I wonder if people will be pushing a little bit more to have that happen.
Let's go back to Paul for just a minute. Paul, one of the things, do you think there's really support for fewer police officers, especially given what the news looks like these days? I just don't quite get that.
I don't either. I wrote an editorial in which I characterized that as the mayor's Washington Monument play. I mean, that, to me, we just trained a bunch of police officers, 29, 30 of them, and those are going to be the first to go. We would let them go. We're paying to train officers for other communities. It doesn't make any sense to me. Nobody wants fewer police officers. Everybody wants more, and they want more firefighters. Mm-hmm. Public safety, after all, is the primary job of government. If they can't do that, then the rest of it's...
Steve, you have something to add?
Well, I think as always, what you see, I look at, and I'm sure Paul has a similar idea, I think. But I always look at these as negotiations in a lot of ways.
Like, yeah,
here's the worst case scenario.
That's right.
And here's not such a bad scenario. Which one do you want? You know, and so there's a lot of wheeling and dealing and horse trading that goes on between them, any mayor, not just Mayor Sullivan, but any mayor that we've had and any assembly that's going on. And it goes on at the state level as well, between the governor and the legislature. But I think this is, you know, I don't want to say scare tactic, but it's a scare tactic to say, this is what's going to happen if we do this, but it's not so bad if we do this. But you got to do this to get to that. You know.
So. Okay, let's stick with Mayor Sullivan, who is sticking with the sidewalk law, despite its unpopularity with the assembly. Steve, what's the mayor trying to accomplish here?
Well, this goes back to a protest. Basically a one-man protest who camped out on the City Hall parking sidewalk. He was protesting the mayor's stance on handling homeless camps. The mayor came up with the sidewalk ordinance that's modeled after one that he had heard about and researched in Seattle. And the assembly first go around, you know, there was, again, a lot of debate over this one, but the assembly approved it. And then all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but a while back, after a while it passed, Dick Traney came up and said, I got second thoughts about this thing now. And so it was kind of to do in the sidewalk ordinance, or at least gut it, pretty much. And now the mayor says, well, no, I'm going to veto this, and he has vetoed it. I think the mayor is just sticking to his guns on this. This is something that he wanted, he fought for, he won. And now some assembly members who supported it the first time around have come back and said, oh, I've got second thoughts. Well, he doesn't have second thoughts. He's sticking to his guns on this particular one. And I think he's just fighting for it. Whether we need this thing or not, I don't know. I haven't tripped over anybody on the sidewalk yet, but you never know.
I was out of town for 10 days or something, and the gentleman protester was there.
He's there,
before
yeah,
I left.
Yeah.
He might be there today, as far as I know. Yeah. It's kind of chilly here in Anchorage. Paul, how would you characterize public reaction to this? Is there significant public support for this? Is there public indifference? What do you think?
I think it's somewhere between indifference and support generally, but I think there's...
I gave you some room there.
I know, I had some room to slot.
Column A, column B. Which one do you want?
There was a segment in the community that are very, very concerned and vociferously about free speech rights. Mm-hmm. They try to characterize all of this as a free speech issue. The mayor says, no, it's not. I don't want people laying on the sidewalk. So there's been no giant surge of anger from the public about this. So I don't think there's much to be done at this point.
Okay, let's move ahead. ConocoPhillips, BP, and Exxon send Governor Parnell a letter discussing the natural gas pipeline. They estimate now the big moment in this letter was that it could cost up to $65 billion to build a Trans-Alaska gas line with related facilities to Tidewater to send the natural gas overseas. Paul, wow, that's quite the estimate. Tell us about it.
$65 billion is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Back at his State of the State speech, Governor Parnell asked the three majors on the North Slope and TransCanada, which is involved in AGEA, to come up with a plan and a schedule and a program so that we can build a pipeline to Tidewater. They're not sure where yet. So they said, well, they went to work. They've got 200 people working on this. They issued their proposed schedule, I guess, and their plan and a letter, all manner of things this week, trying to explain where they are on the project. But it's not, there's no commitment there. They're not saying, yes, we're going to do it, or no, we're not. But we go back to the same old bugaboo that we've always had. They need a fiscal plan from the state. They need bedrock tax policies they can work off of. And all of those remain in the future. They're not going to make a decision about whether to build this for another 4 or 5 years. Meanwhile, as was noted in the newspaper, China et al. Are moving ahead with their projects. The reason it's $65 billion, it started off around $20 to $40 billion when they first talked about the pipeline. But now they're talking about adding a gas liquefaction refraction plant. And that's going to add a lot of money onto this. And none of this, really, the $65 billion, does not include tankers.
Yeah.
So there's going to need 10 to 15 tankers to be in a port someplace. So,
Steve, we've been through this for many mucho years, decades.
Yeah.
Does this get us any closer to that magic day when shovels are turning dirt?
No, it doesn't. And you can kind of see that in the way Dan Sullivan, not the mayor, but Commissioner Dan Sullivan, and the Parnell administration.
Natural Resources.
Thank you. How they put this out there. It was there was always like, well, we've got this answered and this answered and this answer, but there are a lot of bumps in the road and we got a long way to go yet. And so they're kind of giving everybody a dose of reality while they're handing out some what seems to be some good news. I think they filled in quite a few of the blanks and more so than what we certainly had before. But there's an awful long way to go on this. I do think that Governor Parnell really breathed new life into the project when he came up with this suggestion last year and said, what about Asia? And because it certainly didn't seem like we were going anywhere fast when we were talking about hooking a pipeline into Canada and going to the Midwestern United States. That just didn't seem like that was going to, and I still don't think it's going to work, even if they decided to turn dirt on that tomorrow. That place is saturated in natural gas, and they can't get the price to really support or justify a pipeline. And the market seems to be in Asia. But again, they're going to have to go quickly because, as Paul said, other countries are proceeding with their gas line projects.
Paul, maybe it's we have too many senior journalists here with white hair, gray hair, who have seen too much of this. Our friend Dermot Cole in Fairbanks describes the letter as underwhelming. And he points out that it was signed not by the CEOs of the three major corporations,
minor
but
functionaries.
Executives of lesser light. And he goes on to say there are no commitments or deadlines, but plenty of escape clause and general statements that are harder to read than tea leaves. Is our dear friend being too hard on
this? No, I think he's exactly accurate. They were asked by the governor of the state of Alaska to do something. The governor is a powerful man in a powerful position. He can make life miserable for virtually anybody he wants to.
Make life better in Alaska.
There's a positive spin to this as well, but they understand that they're now dealing with the state and they're not going to turn their back and walk away. They're going to at least move forward with trying to find out if this can be done. You've got to congratulate them for that. We're a lot further today than we were 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Let's try something new. The APOC learned through their processes that BP paid Republican Senate candidate, State Senate candidate, Bob Bell, $1 million for contract work for his firm. It didn't go to Bell himself personally, but to his firm. This made the front page and got a lot of attention all over the media. Steve, what's going on here?
Bob Bell, former Anchorage Assembly member, and he represents South Anchorage when he was on the Assembly. He's running for that hotly contested West Anchorage Senate seat right now against incumbent Hollis French, who's a target, talk about trying to make life miserable. Governor Parnell would love to see Senator French booted out of office. So this is an important race for Republicans, but Mr. Bell released information that to APOC that showed that his engineering firm, had gotten a $1 million contract from BP. And one of the biggest issues that it's going to be before the legislature next session will, of course, be once again the oil tax issue. Governor Parnell wants oil taxes lowered to spur more production. Mr. Bell, should he win, he would be sitting there in the legislature passing judgment on a proposal or several proposals, even perhaps. And is he in the back pocket of the oil industry by receiving a $1 million contract? Now, he says he had sold his firm, to an employee group, and he felt that because he was no longer the owner.
He made it clear the money didn't go to his personal bank
account.
Right.
He just felt he didn't have to disclose whose clientele is at this point to AIPAC. AIPAC said, no, you have to do that. And actually, this came after a complaint was filed by
a Democrat.
A Democrat in his district. And it does raise a lot of questions, but at the same time, we have a citizen legislature. We've got people in the legislature who work for the oil industry. It raises questions, and it certainly is something that needs to be addressed, because he would be sitting in judgment of oil tax reform, other issues affecting the oil industry, and he's got to be held accountable for that.
Paul, did the AIPAC process work adequately, or as it's supposed to in this particular case?
Well, I think you could argue that either way. The rule changed late last year. Mr. Bell said that he was unaware of the change when he didn't release all this information to start with. The AIPAC staff is recommending that a $1,000 fine not be levied, because it understands that the rule changed late, and maybe someone wouldn't understand that. I'm glad AIPAC's there, and AIPAC does a good job, but I think it's often criticized for being too strict over minor things and letting big things go. Mm-hmm. In this case, I think it handled it very well.
And one of the things we learned from the investigation of the legislature, the FBI's investigation of certain legislators, was there people who in the legislature will take advantage of AIPAC by calling up and saying, now can I do this, that, or something, trying to figure out just how close they can come to the edge of the law.
The flip side of it, I've talked to two people who call and do just that, and ask and get the answer and then do it, and then later are castigated. You do it in writing. That's what I would do. That's what I always tell people. Work with these guys to do it in writing. But I think AIPAC is one of those agencies. I'm not going to do an ad for them, but they need better funding, more investigators, and if we're going to be serious about clean elections, they're the guys that can do it.
No, that's a really good point to raise. I mean, they got a staff that's like this big.
Nothing.
Yeah,
okay.
And they've got to keep an eye on all these characters who are running for office, and I think really the citizens of the state of Alaska are part of the backup for these folks. And things change, and maybe they don't get the word out to everybody, and maybe candidates aren't as diligent as they should be checking into what they can do and what they can't do, and sometimes they just bumble into things. But I do think that, I think AIPAC does as good a job as it possibly can with the size staff that it has. And the legislature, let's face it, they do their best to defang these guys every chance they get. They're always trying to ratchet them in. They're barely keeping the lights on as it is.
Most members feel that they can only cause trouble for me.
Exactly.
Yeah, good.
Some version of it.
They should.
Steve, let's stick with you for another matter, and that is during the course of this story, it was revealed that earlier Vico and Bill Allen and his organization approached Bob Bell with offers of contracts and campaign money, and all in exchange for help with the private prison.
This is the most troubling aspect, I think, of the story. I've known Bob Bell for a long time. I've interviewed him a number of times. He's a good guy. He's a good guy who's served the community well. And I like Bob Bell. I like Hollis French. I've known them both for a long time. But I don't think Bob Bell would do anything illegal. But it bothers me that he didn't say, this is what happened. That he didn't say to the FBI or somebody or to the assembly, say, I got this. This happened to me. Now, to his credit, he says, the people of South Anchorage didn't want that prison out there. That's where they were proposing to build this thing, and I didn't support it. So he didn't compromise there. He didn't sell out for any kind of bribe or whatever you want to call it. But I'm anxious to see if this goes a few more steps down the road, if somebody comes up and says, well, we're going to look into this thing, because this follows exactly what happened with the other legislators who wound up going to jail.
Well, except he didn't get any benefit from it, right?
No, he did not. Yeah. No, he didn't. He didn't get any benefit, and I'm not suggesting that.
I think there are other people who were involved in this investigation who were also asked or told that they could benefit and said no.
Yeah. I'm not saying anything that Mr. Bell did anything illegal here. He did turn them down. I guess I'd feel a lot better if maybe he'd have turned
them in. Well, ultimately, isn't this going to become between Bell and his constituents?
I think so.
Or potential constituents, the voters in his district.
I think so. The decision's in their lap. I think it would be unfair to judge him as if BP was some kind of criminal organization. It's not. Mm-hmm. Businesses all over town in Alaska do millions and millions of dollars worth of business. There will be a conflict. We have legislators in the legislature now who just simply declare your conflict and go about your business. Mm-hmm. I don't think he has a business, an engineering firm, that does a lot of survey work for many, many clients. I don't know how you can hold that against him. And he's not controlling the firm. He gets a $200,000 or $400,000, whatever it is, $200,000 salary from him.
Right.
He sold it to his employees. The voters will have to look at all of that, and I think, and weigh it, and at the same time, you know, keep in the back of their mind that BP is it's a God-fearing, straight-up corporation. You know,
Wait a minute. They've had all kinds of trouble in Texas and other places.
No, but not up here. They have. I mean, of course they have. They've had
the
problems.
Corrosion.
With,
Yeah.
And if you want to judge them on that, fine.
Yeah.
But when it comes down to doing business in Alaska, they do it everywhere.
It's a small territory when it comes to that. Yeah. It, again, it's a citizen legislature, and you could say the same thing about people who are fishermen and who are in the legislature.
That has been said.
Oh yeah, and they've got to sit and judge fishing issues in legislation.
See, it doesn't seem what's different here is that it is a large amount of money.
It is an awful lot of money. But again, and I'm not trying to make excuses. I think everybody's got to ask these questions before you go in and vote. We've got people who work for the oil industry, with Kevin Meyer.
Yeah.
Peter Michicki, who just won his seat down there in the Soldotna area. He works for the oil industry. So.
Paul, you had something you want to add?
The idea of the legislature in Alaska is a citizen legislature. Mm-hmm. Everybody in there shouldn't be a professional politician with no other job. It would be better for the state if everybody had a job and had to declare conflict. And BP has a record in Alaska. It's had some problems in Alaska. It's had problems elsewhere. It's doing business with them. It's doing business with other people. What he has to do, apparently, is what he's done. He's an honorable man, he sits down and he does his job, and if he's required to disclose, he should disclose.
Mm-hmm. Let's continue with the Senate races. Paul, there are big Senate races at the future of perhaps the taxation, oil taxes is at stake. Certainly the future of organization of the legislature is at stake. What are we hearing out on the campaigns?
It's not.
Isn't that interesting? That's the most interesting thing.
Hottest, the hottest one, and even it, I mean, it is mostly a tax on Bob Bell. it's the Bell-French contest is drawing the most interest, probably drawing the most money. I haven't checked APOC the last
week.
No,
I haven't.
I think maybe they don't have as much money this time out as they normally do, and they're waiting to, you know, right closer to the election. I don't know.
Paul, also, don't we have some races that are... There's only one candidate. They
a lot
primary
of
winner locked it up.
A lot of those.
That they're not competitive.
There's a lot of those. We have
Steve,
a lot of them.
It's been real quiet. In fact, I think the most effective ads are the ones that really make me sit up and take notice are the ones where you have Republicans and Democrats pictured together. You've got a Hollis French and a Liesl McGuire ad where they both come up face or side by side and saying, "Oh, let's applaud these senators." You know, so it's almost like a kumbaya kind of
that's
thing.
That's the anti-change people,
right? The pro coalition, the pro tax. So you see that. I think this election, the last couple. Have been so hot. We had Lisa Murkowski and Joe Miller a couple years ago, and that was amazing. And then 4 years ago, we had an incredible organization up here for the Obama administration. There was a time where we thought Obama may be the first Democratic presidential candidate to carry Alaska since Lyndon Johnson in 1964. He really...
And boy, were we wrong.
Well, then that Sarah Palin gal walked into the thing and took over the state again. That blew everything up. But this is like very... It pales by the last couple of elections. Yeah.
Really
okay, as
happening.
They say now for something completely different. A Kodiak woman falls off a cliff, falls 60 feet while texting. This is the kind of story that gets national attention. Meanwhile, in Central Park... Boston Red Sox manager, now former manager, Bobby Valentine, fell off his bicycle while texting.
Rough week for Bobby Valentine.
Is this a social phenomenon, Paul, texting that has no limits?
Yes, the short answer is yes. People, I think, would rather text than eat sometimes. And I've told you before the show, I had a woman walk down the sidewalk. I could see her coming. I had the green light, and she was texting and walked right off the curb, right out into traffic and across the street. And didn't get killed. How it happened, I don't know. I saw her coming, I stopped. I don't know how she didn't get run over. But I'm not sure of what the attraction is. It's probably because I'm an old white guy. But I just don't, it's not worth your life.
I heard somebody lecture on this, and this professor's idea. It's the lure of being connected.
Yes.
And the technology
yes.
is just so powerful.
Yes.
You want to know what's going on.
We can't be alone, and we have to be plugged in. I mean, that's what you have.
Okay. So you sit alone in a room.
Let's give
and you
Steve
text
McDonald.
Everybody.
We're going to run out of time here.
Yeah.
Steve, what's society's role here? Do we have to not only say it's wrong to text when you're driving, but it's wrong to text when you're on your bicycle, it's wrong to text, mm-hmm. fill out the list.
Well,
what do we do here?
Well,
what do we expect people to come to their senses?
I think so. They need to do that, and I hope it doesn't take somebody really, really getting hurt before we all come to our senses on this. We're seeing it with texting and driving. A lot of people are frowning on that and saying you can't do that anymore. It's going to be against the law. I don't know if you can say you can't text and walk off a cliff. You can't text and ride your bike. I don't know if you have a law for that. But it's new, it's evolving, the technology is brand new, and it keeps changing. You can do more things with these phones, you can redirect Russian satellites, whatever you can do with these things, they're pretty amazing, and I think it takes people...
I would add one thing, Stephen, that is we're at the beginning of this revolution, right?
Yeah, oh, we are. Oh, not even close. Yeah, we're not even... Yeah, we have just started on this whole thing, so...
But when it comes to beginning and ends, we are at the end of Alaska Edition. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.